Hello and welcome back to Callum and David's Any Requests podcast. This is, of course, the podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month via Patreon and get us to do a podcast on absolutely anything you want.
That is correct, as always. And this week we have been given an absolute gem of a podcast subject. This request comes from Ben.
Yes.
What's Ben Norman has given quite a few different requests.
Yes, so we have been for Ben trawling through the Crime Traveller journey. And
thank you, kind of, for that, Ben.
And he specifically requested this one because he enjoyed our frequent exasperation at unnecessary carrying of guns.
Yeah,
which is what made him think of the show we're going to be talking about today, which is, of course, the 2004 1980s set sci-fi comedy parody, cult classic.
Good description.
Yeah. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
It would have been better if I hadn't interrupted you before you finished it. That's very good.
Yeah.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is something that I became aware of, when it came out, I was 14 years old. And I've talked about a couple of kind of shows that we've been asked to talk about over our time on Any Requests as kind of being things that were talked about at school. And it was genuinely a time where you'd come in the next day and go, did you see that last episode? Things like Nighty Night and Mighty Boosh. But this was a really kind of early one, and it was the only thing of its kind that I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And looking back, I don't think that's just because I was a kid. Actually, it was genuinely very, very fresh.
Yeah.
At the time. I don't know what your memory of it first time round was.
Yeah, so what would I have been? 16, 17 when it came out. Very much just kind of being made aware of that style of comedy, like you say, with Boosh, with Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
That kind of dry, British, slightly surreal kind of irony. The show's very much populated with the same kind of people that you see in this, very similar senses of humour.
Yeah.
A lot of that is facilitated through Steve Coogan's Baby Cow and
absolutely,
other production companies that collected the same kind of group of people together, and that branches out into Spaced and and all these guys kind of end up sort of orbiting the same kind of alternative early noughties alternative comedy scene in Britain.
Yeah, and I think that alternative comedy is something that some people balk at because it isn't. It's just comedy. It's just moving on. But it is a real rebellion. And I think what's interesting about all of those shows is that none of them have a similar genre.
Yeah.
The genre is that it doesn't matter. And the content is really not the star of the show. It's the commentary that's going on within each line, each episode, each overarching series.
Yeah.
I say commentary as if it's really highbrow. it's not a huge social commentary, although there are elements of that, but just constant observational comedy that's hidden within the surreal structure. So it's a really clever, fun, exciting, or it certainly was for me as a teenager, really exciting to get behind.
Yeah.
And it meant also that I felt that I could write, because I'd never been moved to write comedy about a genre or about a place or about... But I wanted to enjoy... I really enjoyed the way in which this comedy was presented, and it made me feel like I could write, and I did start writing some terrible sitcom parodies with my friend Josh. I should probably look back at them if I was brave enough to do so. It really kind of helped me start actually having a go at writing some comedy, which I loved.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place started out life as a Edinburgh Fringe production first, called Garth Marenghi's Fright Nights with a K, created by Matthew Holness, who went on to create the series. Matthew Holness, along with Richard Ayoade, were part of Cambridge Footlights, which, for those of you who don't know, is a kind of seminal comedy troupe from Cambridge University that has been going since, you know, well, probably far longer, but kind of came to prominence really in the 60s with the Pythons, and before that Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and the Beyond the Fringe lot.
I was going to say the Beyond the Fringe, Jonathan Miller. Took the Footlight. Footlights, I think, it offered a bit of a theatrical thing for a long time, but yeah. Never quite what it now is, which is all about the comedy.
Yeah.
You're right. Mitchell and Webb and Fry and Laurie and yeah. kind of loads of people have gone through.
So
that Footlights yeah. machine almost.
So you mentioned Mitchell and Webb. David Mitchell and Robert Webb were part of the troupe that Matt Holness and Rich Diawade were in. They were there at the same time, as was John Oliver as well. So they were all part of the same kind of year group. And they were sort of, I suppose you had, after them, there was really one last kind of great, quote unquote, year group, which was that of Simon Bird and Joe Thomas
right.
and Johnny Sweet. And kind of since then, they've sort of fallen off the radar a little bit. And it's kind of, there's various theories of whether Cambridge kind of stopped funding Footlights as much and they didn't facilitate the Edinburgh shows as much as they did, but also just oversaturation at Edinburgh Fringe people looking elsewhere, and there are arguments to say that's not wholly a negative thing, because certainly there's so much elitism around Oxbridge and the favoritism that those universities get, it's not necessarily a bad thing that people are casting their net wider and finding talent elsewhere. But yeah, it's been a while since we've seen a real kind of grad group from Footlights really come to prominence in the way people like Mitchell and Webb have, in the way people like Armstrong and Miller as well did.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of great British comedians came out of that. Matt Holness is an interesting character because he was reading a Guardian article about him and he just kind of confounded everyone because he didn't really have the career everyone expected after Garth Marenghi, because that was kind of his real kind of first big
step on the ladder.
And although it didn't do hugely well in terms of ratings, Channel 4 put it on quite late at night. It got great reviews, and the theme tune was nominated for a BAFTA for Best New Series, which is odd. He then kind of disappeared. Got a bit sort of, I think, dejected with the whole world of comedy, because he'd been doing bits of stand-up and things like that as well, and bits of kind of character comedy live, very fringy kind of stuff. And then kind of has been sort of bit part actor. He was most recently in The Haunting of Bly Manor on Netflix.
Yeah.
As the dad, who I won't say any more in case you've not seen it. He appears in several episodes of that.
He's been doing a lot of writing as well, though. I noticed that a couple of years ago he did a film called Possum, which I haven't seen.
Yes, it's a horror film, absolutely
yeah.
not comedy at all. It was an interview in this Guardian article, and he was talking about it, and he just said he didn't feel like he had anything funny left to say, so he kind of switched up genres. But great reviews. I've not seen it either, but I think it's got 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, and apparently very, very good creepy film about a disgraced puppeteer who goes back home to confront the abuse he suffered at the hands of his uncle, I think. So it's quite dark by the sounds of it.
I mean, I think that is, it doesn't surprise me about Matthew Holness that he's drawn to the dark. And actually, I noticed that he'd written, I haven't seen any of these, but a Playhouse series. I think Harry Shearer, famous American comedian, founded of standalone one acts, and Jeremy Dyson's done one, and Matthew Holness has done one.
Yes, Harry Shearer plays Nixon.
I've seen them.
Yeah, they're brilliant. They're brilliant.
Portland Grady's written one.
Yes.
Like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. They're all on Sky Arts.
I'll have to make my way through some of those then.
They're really good. The show, he won a Perrier at age 26 in Edinburgh.
This show, Garth Marenghi's Fright Night, the sequel the next year, won a Perrier, right?
Yes, and that's when it was picked up by Channel 4 commissioners, and they commissioned this 6-part series. And yeah, that's what became Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is, yeah, kind of as I said at the beginning, first of all, it's very meta.
Yeah, extremely.
Because you've got Matt Holness, Richard Ayoade, the great Matt Berry,
Alice Lowe,
playing people playing people.
Yeah.
So it's
set up as a retrospect, isn't it? The whole thing is framed so you're tuning in to a look back at this piece of work that never really got as much credit as it deserved, as a great piece of art by this Garth Marenghi character, who is kind of loosely based on Stephen King, down to the glasses, quite similar, but completely kind of, you know, made British and parodied a great deal. I don't think Stephen King would find it offensive, to say the least. So they're looking back at their time on this show. So you watch quite a bit of the show.
I think probably more like kind of Clive Barker, like someone a bit more low rent, a horror novelist than Stephen King, I'd say.
Yeah, maybe. But in terms of who it was based on, it was based on Stephen King. So, but yeah, you're right. In reality, it's someone who thinks he's Stephen King, but absolutely isn't.
Exactly.
You're right.
Dean Koontz.
Yeah. So you're you know, as the viewer, watching them talk about this great show, and then it will just kind of show you a clip, but the clip will last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it'll be brought out of it, and it'll be back to a talking heads scenario. That kind of show within a show, which is obviously fake, like you say, it's very meta.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know whether, I can't remember what it was like when I was a kid, but I don't know whether I clocked it straight away or not. I probably did, because you hear about it before you see it. But it's so well observed. It's so accurate. Richard Ayoade, who I'll talk about a lot as kind of like the master of detail, does this wonderful thing where he's obviously not experienced. His character,
Dean Lerner,
can't decide whether to look at the camera or the person interviewing, and you see that a lot in like talking head things, and he's just got that and then turned it up to 11.
Yeah.
That's a real great example of Ayoade's comedy, which I think shines in this.
Yeah. So Dean Lerner being the publisher of Garth Marenghi's books and not an actor.
Yeah.
And says as much to Garth Marenghi, which Dean Lerner then says he responded with saying, "I'm not looking for people to act, I'm looking for people to tell the truth."
And his response is, "So this is not me putting on an act, it's me putting on the truth. Yeah. I was like, "Oh, that is acting." there are some fantastic lines in this, and we could mention them all. But I think one of the things, we watched 3 episodes in preparation for this out of the 6 that are available from the first series. In fact, that was it, wasn't it? There weren't any other episodes made.
Yeah. Although there was the spin-off, Man to Man with Dean Lerner, which was like a chat show hosted by Dean Lerner, and Garth Marenghi was the first guest.
Which I've never seen, I really liked it.
I saw that before I saw Dark Place. Came across that first and then went back and watched Dark Place because I loved Man to Man so much. But yeah, and it's Matt Holness playing pretty much all the other characters as well. Different versions of characters, yeah.
So the first episode of the series and the first one we watched in prep for this was Once Upon a Beginning. Mm. And it is kind of... I mean, the story is, as with all of Dark Place, is it's set in a hospital called Dark Place.
Yeah.
And it's in the 80s, and we're in Britain. All the characters are British, largely, but it's all written as if it's meant to be said by American characters. And it's never talked about.
It's a very much an American hospital.
It's never mentioned, but it's just there. And one of the greatest things about it that I'd completely forgotten is how much ADR they've done in... So, because it's meant to be a cheaply made film, the idea is that it will, you know, TV series, the idea is that when you're actually watching the hospital Dark Place program, the sound quality is so bad that they keep having to do ADR.
Yeah.
But the ADR is really good quality.
Yeah.
And I think majority of it is ADR. ADR, for those who aren't aware, is when you're an actor and you're doing a scene, and for whatever reason, They haven't clocked it when you were filming it, but the sound quality wasn't very good. And so you have to go back into a studio and then you have to record your vocals, trying to sync it up to your lips moving. It's like the opposite of lip syncing on the screen.
Additional dialogue recording.
There you are. And I think probably the majority of this is all ADR. And I was like, but that means they would have had to actually go and do that.
Yeah.
If anyone has got any insider knowledge of whether they managed to somehow do that, because that would have taken so much time, much more than the budget of a half-hour Channel 4 comedy.
It's more than the ADR, though. It's all the sound levels in general. Yeah. They're so deliberately mismatched, completely the wrong volume for, like, where things are and what they are. Like, there's a point where Dean Lerner gets out of a chair and the sound of the chair scraping on the floor as he gets out is like three times as loud as the dialogue. And like, it's so well observed. But just picking up on what you said about that kind of American style, I think that's a really clever observation of a lot of those shows from the 80s.
Yeah.
There seemed to be this period in British television in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, that started to really fetishize American television, especially like sci-fi shows or kind of spy shows or action kind of based, was taking their cues a lot from American TV. And I think that's a real nice nod to that.
But again, just turned up to the max. But it's just never discussed or talked about.
It's interesting with Dark Place, because I wouldn't call it a spoof. Well, because it's like it doesn't put... if you put it against something like Naked Gun, Airplane, you know, you've not got, like, you know, the kind of scattergun sight gags and play on words, and it's not as overtly silly. Like, it's authentic
in its
badness and it's pastiching things, but it's a different tone, I'd say, than a spoof.
I think the reason why it got called, well, Lynn Gardner saw it at Edinburgh and called it a spoof. Chortle reviewed it, said it was great spoof comedy. And then I don't know whether that, and maybe watching it live, you know, with one set and one, you know, maybe that is kind of how it came across, but certainly something might have changed between the stage show and this six-part miniseries, because you're right, it's so they commit to it so much that it's not really a spoof of a genre, it's a genre on itself. And I think that's, and it's a spoof on a time, so you're right, it's not strictly a kind of a recognizable, oh, that's a spoof of something, or they're sending up that, it's they're sending up two imaginary characters who make television who never existed, so isn't there, how can it be a spoof? Do you see what I mean? I also absolutely adore the fact that Garth Marenghi and Dean Lerner constantly use French really in kind of random inappropriate places. It's just another kind of a thing that a pretentious character in a comedy might do. And so they've done that. But this isn't within the bit that's meant to be the spoof. This is in the fictional talking head section. So it's, again, it's like another layer of meta where you're going, oh, you're parodying this this pretentious writer thing, as well as the people who are making the actual thing, as well as the product itself. So it's wheels within wheels within wheels, but that detail, and it's relentless is how I would describe it.
But his Holness has created this character, but he's with such an admirable amount of realism to the level of ego that he has. Like, he's not pushed it so it's unbelievable. Like there are lines he say that are funny because it's so close to what someone who's completely unaware of the real level of their importance in the industry they're in would say. Like there's a bit where there's a bit where he's talking about Matt Berry's character and he says something along the lines of, like, you know, and, you know, he's Todd Rivers is the name of Matt Berry's character. And he says, you know, Todd Rivers is so great. In fact, some of the scenes you end up, you know, watching him as much as you're watching me.
Yeah.
And so it's that subtlety of like, oh my God, you've got such a huge ego, but you think you're being modest right now, rather than just playing someone with a massive ego. Like, it's so clever.
Yeah. Very, very, very clever. With respect to all the kind of ADR, bad editing, deliberately dodgy production values, and also kind of bad continuity, I couldn't help but think about the fact that the reason we're here talking to you right now is because of a Jonathan Creek podcast where we watched every single episode of Jonathan Creek in existence and found that this was a constant. In every episode, there was some ADR. There was always a bit of rubbish ADR where the miming didn't match up, or it was really obviously done in the studio and not outside in a field where they're meant to be. There was always a continuity error, and there was always a line that didn't quite make sense. And I feel like it's just condensed the amount of mistakes into a whole Jonathan Creek episode. It condenses that into about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And so there, I would say it's probably about 1/6 of the, you know, 6 times the mistakes you'd get in a Jonathan Creek episode, which is not a compliment to Jonathan Creek. I mean, that's far too many errors that are in Jonathan Creek. And remember, this isn't, Jonathan Creek's not a period piece.
No.
It is something that the last few episodes were a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And still those errors are that consistent.
I mean, on that note, one thing that made me really happy about the first episode is that there is a character in it called Renwick.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you needed any more proof.
He is living in all of us.
Yeah.
There was also a line, I think you said, that was almost exactly from a Jonathan Creek episode that you and I were trying to work out the meaning of.
It's from Dance Macabre. It's the American Minder guy. At the end, when he says, to what and by whom?
Yeah.
That literally Dean Lerner says that in the fictional Dark Place show as his character in that. He says, basically.
By whom and to what end?
By whom, yeah. It's so similar and delivered exactly the level of acting that guy delivered it in Jonathan Creek. I was like, I had to pause. I was like, wait, that's identical to that line in Jonathan Creek.
The actor doesn't understand the grammar of this sentence and they're just going at it. But the grammar is all over the place but with pretense. It's the type of mistakes that people make when they're trying to sound worthier than they are. And that's what's such a joy about this whole Garth Marenghi's Dark Place experience.
Yeah.
We've all met versions of those people in our lives, especially in showbiz. And I think that's makes it quite niche in that regard.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe modern audiences today, I say modern audiences 2004, it's quite a long time ago now, would be a little bit more clued up about that. I think they're, you know, the audiences are let behind the curtain a bit more than they used to be. But I think it would probably do better now than it would have when it was released.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it wouldn't be what it is if it was.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
The second episode we looked at was called Hell Hath Fury.
Yeah.
Which gives you an idea, again, just the episode titles themselves. Someone just pitching it slightly wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. And this one's really interesting in the sense that there is a bit. If I said there wasn't any social commentary in it,
yeah.
But there is quite a bit. Because we have this character played by Alice Lowe, who plays a doctor, a female doctor, and there's kind of lots of comments throughout the series about her gender and the fact that there's some sexism at play.
Yeah.
But this episode is all about the fact that we've learned in episode one that Alice Lowe's character has the power of telekinesis. She can move things.
Two words, telekinesis.
and this episode is the fact that her telekinesis gets exacerbated when she suffers from premenstrual tension, or PMS, premenstrual stress, as they've described it. And she gets so angry because there is no chicken. The chicken lunch isn't ready in the hospital lunch restaurant. And the chef is played by Stephen Merchant.
Yeah, bizarrely.
Comes in. I'm like, why is Stephen Merchant in this? I'm assuming there must have just been people who saw the show at Edinburgh and kind of got invested in it. Although, actually, when did The Office come out?
What was that, 2001? So this would have been post-Office.
Because I think because Matt Holness was in The Office as Simon, as a small character. He must have known Stephen Merchant. That must have been a connection there.
Yeah.
Through that. We also have Julian Barrett, who guest stars in a couple of the episodes.
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time, Once Upon a Beginning.
So my theory about why Matt Berry is in this show.
I was asking you, what's the connection with Matt Berry?
So I am assuming, I've done a bit of research. This is a bit like that old, remember Comedy Connections, BBC Two? How those people met.
And the answer was always Barry Cryer.
So Matt Berry worked with Julian Barrett and Noel Fielding in 2000 on a show at the Hen and Chickens Theatre. So,
and they were I didn't just know this, but I looked up and I saw that Julian Barrett and Noel Fielding were resident at the Hen and Chickens, weren't they?
Yeah. So my guess is that Holness and Iowade did either Fright Nights or something else at the Hen and Chickens, met Barrett and Fielding. Then they said, "You've got to meet this guy, Matt Berry." And I'm making this up, but all the clues link together. And hey, look, I was right about Manson, wasn't I? Got all that right.
You were absolutely right about that.
Solved the Manson mystery. So
and MK Ultra.
So I think I'm right about this.
I think you probably will be. Mm. To be honest, Richard O'Hardy lives down the road from us, so we probably could knock on his door and ask him. Although that would be insensitive during COVID times, and also possibly a little bit creepy.
Yeah, this is true.
But Richard, if you're listening, fill us in.
Now, Stephen Merchant.
What? Where are you going with this?
Stephen Merchant. I think it's important I tell our listeners about this. Stephen Merchant, recently, I have a weirder connection to now.
No,
because
you don't.
No, it's a one-way connection. and it's subconscious. Because about 3 weeks ago, I had a dream that Callum and I were sat in our flat. And Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer, you know, that duo,
classic,
that famous
comedy duo. Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer.
No idea why. Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer came into our flat and they had fake Victorian sideburns glued onto their face, like costume. And they were coming to get fitted for some kind of period thing. And for some reason, we had all the costumes for whatever they were filming in our kitchen. But they didn't acknowledge us like it was our flat. It was just like we were also in the costume place. They didn't really talk to us. And they just sort of walked in. And I remember being confused as to why they weren't acknowledging that they were in our flat.
And why didn't you know why the costume was here?
Yeah, I don't know. It was just there. And that's where they were getting fitted up.
Three weeks ago, you've been thinking about this for nearly a month.
It was such a vivid dream. And it felt so real, and it felt like it went on for a long time. But I think the overriding thing is now I just want to see something with Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer in.
I think Bob Mortimer would be wearing the sideburns just of his own volition
yeah.
to be funny,
yeah,
and then forget about it and then go on as a business. I don't know why Stephen Merchant was doing it, unless, as a big fan of Bob Mortimer, he was just trying to get along.
Yeah.
But was the costume, were they all period clothes?
Yeah. So
okay.
I think
that they'd already done the makeup in perhaps an actual studio.
Yeah. And then they'd come here to get the costume.
And Stephen Merchant had gone, "All right, I'm ready for a costume now."
Yeah.
And they'd said, "No, you've got to go down to Crystal Palace for that."
Yeah.
to Dave and Callum's flat.
Yeah.
And they'd gone, "Oh, all right then."
Yeah.
And just come down. All right. I mean, maybe they could have been in like the Armando Iannucci's, what was it? David Copperfield.
Yeah.
They could have
That's what
done,
I think they were doing.
They didn't. And that's already, they weren't.
Yeah, no, they weren't. But it was that kind of thing.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you've got your own theory about why Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer might have been in our kitchen.
Yeah, let us know.
You get in touch. You know how to tweet us, at Podcaster Macabre.
My point is, I now have a different connection with Stephen Merchant.
So you now think about that every time you see
him? I now think, yeah. Hopefully that will fade as time goes on and I'll forget about that. But at the moment, that's my first thought when he came on screen. It was, oh God, he's going to be bloody round here getting his costume.
Yeah. I mean, Well, he won't be, because that happened in your mind. Mm. And it's just that, well, it's just that you're ill, and that's fine. There's no judgment on that. That's fine. But you're obviously mentally unwell, and we'll need to work through that. But that's okay.
Alice Lowe, though, is terrific, not just as a performer, but as a writer as well. She co-wrote the brilliant Sightseers, which is Ben Wheatley directed horror comedy.
Very cool.
Yeah. And has also a film I haven't seen, which I really want to, is Prevenge, because I saw all the posters for it a couple of years ago on the tube and everything. It looks great. Again, another kind of horror comedy. And she wrote, directed, and starred in that, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's this, Matthew Honest and Alice Lowe are the two kind of lovers of horror, clearly.
Yeah.
And Ayoade, I don't know, maybe also a great lover of horror. Although Submarine and Double don't speak to that hugely. No. Although I should probably acknowledge the fact that Richard Ayoade, many of you will know from the IT Crowd. Many of you might know him from this. But I think when Submarine came out, I always thought he was clever and funny, and I enjoyed his work, and he seemed like a very intelligent guy, and he's like the best guy you want on a panel show. It could it'll make me watch a panel show that I know I won't enjoy very much because Richard Ayoade's on it. And then Submarine came out, and I went, you're an incredible filmmaker. Yeah. It's a brilliant movie. I mean, you're a cinephile. You probably have, I don't know, a more specific view of it than I do. But it's a beautiful film.
It's an excellent, excellent film.
And I think detail is what it is. And I think that it's interesting that his comic prowess is, for me, always the fact that he's got such incredible attention to detail. And I think that same work ethic carries through his other work. I didn't see The Double with Jesse Eisenberg, but it was really interesting hearing or reading Ayoade talk about the process of that and how much he loves working with actors and collaborating with them and making the film kind of work around the performances and technique, and how much he's a big fan of that.
Yeah, well, I think he got his fingers burnt doing, what was it called? What Neighborhood Watch, whatever that Ben Stiller, Jonah Hill, comedy film that was just because Submarine was suddenly huge in America and the IT Crowd was getting big audiences over in the States, and suddenly Ayoade got on the radar of Hollywood, and I think it was Jonah Hill's production company, I think, was making it, and were like, oh, come on into this, and he just talks about how what a terrible experience it was, like,
really
working in that kind of Hollywood system, and I think it's kind of put him off, and he said that he's not really interested in going back to that kind of world, so I think he's quite happy kind of making relatively small independent films where he can be a bit more of an auteur and have a bit more creative control, and happy doing his travel man stuff in terms of paying the bills and just going, make films when he wants. A
couple of panel shows and then you've got your freedom. Yeah,
absolutely.
Worth bearing in mind, though, he is also the director of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
He's
the person who... So, you know, when you think about how everything's put together and the editing specifically is just so masterful in its wrongness and its incorrectness. That's all him.
There's something quite clever about them doing this from a budget point of view, because they can get away with stuff being bad because it's meant to be bad.
Yeah,
which
it's a good plan.
Halfway through the first episode, I was like, this is real. They're really making this.
Yeah,
and so therefore they could get away with it being crap and not spending that much money on it.
Yeah,
brilliant, genius.
It's not one of those ones where you go, oh, actually, it costs a lot of money to make stuff look bad. You get you've just filmed it on a video camera, you know, and that's it. It's some really, really smart stuff. I think particularly, the when we talk about telekinesis, you know, plates are flying through the air, a stapler is chasing someone down a hallway, and iron is it's just hilariously bad. And, and to quote Lerner's character, you know, if you're focusing on the wires, you're in the wrong, you know, you're not approaching it from the right angle, and this kind of defense of that, and you go, but that is how someone would defend, like, a classic, like an old Dracula movie or a Hammer horror or something. You go, hey, come on, you know, don't talk badly of it just because it's cheap. And you go, well, it's not just that it's cheap; it's that it's just awfully put together.
They've picked up on something that I've I see time and again in documentaries about films or TV shows that weren't that great, is this sort of level of defensiveness and this confusion that people on the outside aren't as enamored with this thing that you made and you have a personal connection to yourself. Yeah. And I think they portray that really, because that comes across a lot in those kind of talking heads things about, like, I mean, like, how David Jason is so obsessed about Del Boy falling through the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't realize until about a year or two ago, I caught a clip on YouTube of him on This Morning talking about it with the precision of, like, Laurence Olivier talking about decoding Hamlet. Like, he's talking about the kind of physics of that scene and the structure of the comedy of it.
Incredible thing. And you go, yeah, it's a funny... Thing is, you and I are both big Stuart Lee fans, and if anyone is kind of aware of Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle, you can check it out and watch all of his stand-up. It's incredible. But there, he does a section on Del Boy falling through the bar being voted as the funniest moment in comedy ever.
It's genius.
And it is a piece of genius, but I still think the character of Stuart Lee's, you know, bitter and twisted and kind of going overboard on this. And then you showed me that clip of him on This Morning teaching Philip Schofield how to fall onto a mat as if he's Nureyev. And I'm no, this is just the character of Stuart Lee has not gone too far. This is absolutely 101 accuracy. It's phenomenal. Brilliant. But yeah, you're right. It's certain people have an inability to see them the way other people see them, which is, you know, sometimes where brilliant comedy is found. And I think actually, you know, you talk about Baby Cow.
Yeah.
This is the whole thing behind Alan Partridge, the whole thing behind Saxondale.
Yeah.
A lot of Coogan kind of stuff. Yeah. And also David Brent. He's unable to see the world, see himself as others see him.
Yeah.
And that's where it's just comedy gold. Yeah. This is just in a different style.
Julia Davis in 99 as well. Oh. Another Baby Cow.
I mean, Julia Davis is probably up there in like terms of my heroes of comedy simply for 99.
Yeah.
I think it's a perfect piece of work.
And married to Julian Barrett. Actually, I don't think they're married, but they've been together for a really long time.
Very nice. Julian Barrett, who obviously is guesting in two of these episodes as the priest or padre.
Padre, yeah.
And he just plays it absolutely as Julian Barrett as well. He doesn't do what anyone else is doing. He just does his thing. And there's something nice about this. And I don't know enough about Alice Lowe's work as a performer. I know that she did a lot with Horrible Histories and a lot of kids' TV as well. Very talented comedian. But it seems like everyone's natural comedy chops, that's what's being brought to the table, is the thing that you do. I want that.
Yeah.
And this is where Matt Berry is absolutely excelling at as well. I mean, he is... quite phenomenal. He makes most of his money doing voiceovers.
Yeah.
And probably has the busiest voiceover agent in the world. I mean, it's phenomenal the amount of work that he does. If you haven't seen some of the BBC comedy shorts, he's up there about 5 minutes long of him narrating nature documentaries.
Yeah.
It is hilarious. It just has me in stitches.
Well, I'm you know, I think there's a real argument to be made for how important Dark Place is on subsequent comedy creations, because I don't think you would have Toast of London without Matt Berry in Dark Place.
It's hard to imagine any of Matt Berry without Dark Place.
Yeah.
Because so much of what he's doing for the first time on camera in this series.
Yeah.
But yeah, his wonderful thing of the mispronunciation of words completely sporadically.
Yeah.
Is just, it catches me every time.
Yeah.
How did you even think of that?
Yeah.
And, you know, and you see it in IT Crowd as well, quite often.
Yeah.
Clearly, actors haven't heard him read this out loud for the first time and, like, trying not to corpse at the way he's saying things. And also, the ADR kind of theme in this plays so beautifully
to his voice,
He's a master performer in terms of voice. He's a master of voice.
Absolutely, yeah.
And of course, because of Dark Place, presumably in terms of the connections of working with Brendan Minahan, Richard Ayoade, Matt Holness, you know, all, and Alice Lowe, actually, they all turn up in IT Crowd at certain points.
Yeah.
And also Julia Barrett turns up in Toast of London. Matt Holness turns up in Toast of London. They're all kind of working with each other. And I should imagine it was a wonderful thing to experience.
Yeah.
Working with these people.
Absolutely. And something that we have to talk about that you and I love is, of course, ADBC, a rock opera.
Oh.
Which just has its roots in Dark Place so much.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
If you've not seen it, because I think about five people in the world have actually seen this, because it was a half an hour, one-off spoof specifically of the 1970s film adaptation of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
That's such a specific thing to spoof. And it was, again, around this time, 2005, on BBC 4 or 3, around Christmas time for half an hour, and then it's never been rebroadcast again. So it's...
You can find bits of it on YouTube.
I've got the DVD of it, actually.
That's commitment. That's incredible.
But it's very much a Lloyd Webber-esque 70s rock opera, but the story of the Nativity from the point of view of the innkeeper.
You no one ever hears from the innkeeper.
No. And it's a work of genius. But yeah, it is Matt Berry, Julian Barrett, Julia Davis, Richard Ayoade, Matt Lucas. Like, it's just
the who's who.
All these comedy greats, and so many of them obviously met and converged during Dark Place.
And I think that in this episode, Hell Half Fury, there is a section where, for no reason, Matt Berry's character...
That's in the final episode.
Oh, is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that, oh, that's the Creeping Moss.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. From the Creeping Moss from the shores of Shaggoth.
Yes.
He turns to Alice Lowe and says, oh, do you want to go out for dinner? And she kind of rejects him, and he, in internal monologue, goes off on one and goes into this song called One Way Lover. And it is just the most well-observed synthwave 80s pop homage. Yeah. I can't really say spoof, because it's the only thing is that every other line is funny.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's just a brilliant piece of synthwave pop from the 80s.
Yeah.
It's perfect. Yeah. And I can only assume that was Matt Berry's composition, because...
It's so similar to the ADBC stuff. But you will be hearing that at the end of this podcast, so look forward to that.
Enjoy.
And
Matt Berry wrote a lot of music, comedy music, for other people, other series. Wrote all the music for Saxondale, funnily enough. I had no idea that he'd done that. Great musician, multi-instrumentalist, fantastic singer. Great.
It's funny you talk about internal monologues. I would say, pound for pound, internal monologues make up more percentage of each show than actual spoken dialogue.
Yeah.
It's so heavy on it. It's constant internal monologues, which is brilliant. There's a bit, I can't remember which episode it's in, but there's a bit that just absolutely killed me where they're talking about slow motion.
Yeah.
And Dean Lerner says, well, the problem is every episode when we finish would run about 8 minutes too short. So any piece of any scene that didn't have dialogue in, was on the table for being made into slow motion. Yeah.
Which is also kind of ridiculous, because everyone's text is machine gun fire. Everyone delivers everything, no matter who, guest artists or regular, that everyone just delivers this nonsense dialogue full of kind of, constant, relentless cliches, normally slightly wrong. It is like a bad horror writer doing a sitcom. It's exactly what you would imagine if you had the ability to imagine something like that hasn't really ever happened. I adore it. There's also something brilliant. We talked about the continuity mistakes of really choosing those shots so carefully that they're really highlighted, but never holding on the shot long enough to make it feel like it's deliberate. Most comedy shows, you're laughing at the comedian doing the character.
Yeah.
And in this, I am laughing at those actors, but first and foremost, I'm laughing at the joke, which is something I don't often do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't often just laugh at the joke and find myself laughing.
Yeah.
But they're constant. And one of them that absolutely floored me was when Alice Lowe's queuing up for the chicken lunch from Stephen Merchant. And Holness gets annoyed, Dag, his character, and he throws her tray on the floor. And she goes to pick it up, and the knife and fork are glued to the tray. For no reason.
Yeah.
And then she picks up the tray, and in the next shot, the tray's got a banana in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, none of this makes sense.
Yeah.
You've gone to this effort to just give these tiny little Easter eggs for those of us who are paying attention.
Yeah.
It just had me in hysterics. I was like, why? Why is that happening?
There's a great bit in the second episode where it's kind of getting to the climax of this whole telekinesis thing, and Alice controlling a fire extinguisher and sort of with her mind throws it into Matt Holness. But there's a bit where it switches to the shot of this temp who's a character in the second episode, but Matt Holness is Garth Marenghi as the actor rather than as the character of the Doctor.
Yeah,
is playing that he's aware that he can still be seen in shot, but they don't have, because he's not the focus of the shot, they don't have the budget to have the fire extinguisher look like it's being in like a force field, look like it's being propelled. So he's just hitting himself with the fire extinguisher. Yeah. And I was just like, that's such a specific thing to think of. And it's for like a second. And I just,
but that's the beauty of it, is that it's such a small, but a great little example of something that just catches you. And had me laughing for a long time. I adored the creeping moss from the shores of Shaggoth, which is this story about a woman coming into the hospital who falls in love with Sanch, which is short for Sanchez.
Yeah.
Played by Matt Berry.
Yeah.
But Graham Transphobe Linehan comes into the hospital as a security guard and leaves her by a ventilation system. Some green mist comes in and she starts turning into broccoli.
Yeah.
That's the story. That's the story of the episode. And at the end, she dies of the being broccoli.
Yeah, and the chefs take her away.
Yeah,
Stephen Merchant's there. Not with any sideburns on, but he's there.
Yeah, he hasn't got his side weird, isn't he? He's got
no
sideburns. And Bob Mortimer
is not assistant. Playing the other chef. When there was another chef, part of me for a second, I was like, oh my God, if that's Bob Mortimer.
Maybe that's where it's subconscious. No, Matt, I want to say Green, who is a funny comedy performer who is a small part in lots of things. I can't tell you what they are, but you recognize his face.
That's a running gag as well, in that every single episode something causes a mist to descend over the hospital. And at the end it goes again, but it's like different colors every episode. It's for completely different reasons, but anything that happens, a mist descends over the hospital. Which is just ridiculous.
But also harking back to the fact that that's what happens in every single horror novel.
Yeah.
And this series has been written by a previously kind of mildly successful horror novelist.
I think in the last episode, he says, much like the brown mist of last week's.
I want to talk about music for a little bit. Mm. You mentioned, obviously, Matt Berry. Wonderful musician, and lovely to see his kind of parody in there. Also, watch it, find it on YouTube anyway, because you get to see Richard Ayoade do a great rap break. It's hilarious. But also, you mentioned at the beginning that this got nominated for a BAFTA.
Yeah, Andy Hewitt.
Andy Hewitt, BAFTA nomination for Best New British Composer. I think you're right. It was for the theme tune.
Yeah,
but the actual award was for Best New British Composer.
Right.
I was like, oh, wow. And then looked up. Of course, he's still been working with Richard Ayoade. He did the music for Submarine.
I saw that, yeah.
And the music for The Double. And about 15, I think, feature films. He now lives in LA.
Mm-hmm.
But he, I noticed that he did the music for The Stanford Experiment, the film. It's a great movie. I really, really enjoyed that film.
Yeah.
Thoroughly recommend it if you haven't seen it. But true story. And good score as well. But weird that Richard Ayoade, who adapted and directed a modern retelling of Dostoevsky. And kind of award-nominated a Hollywood composer.
Yeah.
That's he wrote and directed Garth Marenghi's Darkness.
Yeah.
I just want to say that in a complete sentence.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is that a thing?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is lovely to see Graham Linehan on screen whenever his cameos on Steve Coogan stuff, and Partridge as a writer as well on that. Genius for Father Ted.
Big Train, which we've talked about on this.
Big Train. And we've also talked about this. Shame that he is kind of a transphobe. I think you said, you're watching it, what a weird hill to decide to...
Ruin your career on
as well. Like to be, it's really, really genuinely sad. Worth acknowledging. But nice to see a guy who's contributed an awful lot to comedy. I'm reminded of the, completely not this, but Phil Spector passing away. Mm. The headline was, talented but flawed producer Phil Spector passed away. I was like, flawed? He's a murderer.
He's a murderer.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Talented but murderous producer would be a better line. Why are we doing that? Like, if that was a female, that would be awful psychotic woman who also happened to be, don't know, whatever this fictional person did. That would definitely not lead. Just want to point that out again. I think, to be honest, I don't have a great deal more to say about Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, because you kind of have to watch it to understand any of what we're talking about. And that sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but I think it's just true. There is a great review on IMDb. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to kind of read out, I won't read out all of it, but it just is a lovely little kind of bit at the end of this review. It says, "This is the ultimate for fans of contemporary comedy. Shows that look to push the boundaries and limitations of the human mind. I dare you, or maybe not you, but anyone who hasn't seen Dark Place yet to watch it. It will develop you as a human being." Just...
Is that written by Matt Holness?
That's how I feel.
In character of Garth Marenghi.
That's exactly what I thought when I read it. I was like, this is written by someone who obviously adores it, but also has wanted to get a nod to the writing of Dark Place in the review, in the style of the review that they've given it, which is really, really lovely.
Yeah. So they were commissioned by Film 4 in 2005 to write a film follow-up.
Wow.
But it never happened, and I can't find anything about why it didn't. In my research, articles talking about it, the commission happening, but I can't find anything about why it didn't go ahead or why not. But so at some point that was on the cards. I think it was going to be called War of the Wasps, which I think is referenced in Man to Man. And so I think they were laying the groundwork for it in that. And I think, if I remember, at the end of Man to Man, I think the last episode is like, there's like a teaser for it coming. But then it obviously, never happened for whatever reason.
There you are. I mean, it's not too late.
No.
Come on. 2020 has given everyone a lot of time. Come down from the Hollywood, hills.
Yeah.
And away from the Oscar nominations, and write this sequel movie.
In the case of Malness, from your, I think he lives on like a farm in Norfolk.
I mean, fair enough.
Yeah,
whatever you do. I'll tell you what Matt Berry did in 2020.
Yeah,
talk about his musicianship.
Yeah,
he features on quite a lot of Josh Homme's album Desert Sessions 8 and 9.
Okay.
Josh of
Queens of the Stone Age. Yeah,
I say Homme, Hommy.
Josh Homme. I've always said Josh Homme.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apologies. And, I've got that wrong.
The other one. The other band he's in.
He's in Eagles of Death Metal.
There you go. Eagles of Death Metal.
John Paul Jones.
Yeah.
I think he's also been in quite a few bands.
Yeah.
But he's brilliant and quite terrifying in a really predestined. He looks so normal. And then when he performs, I'm like, you've killed a man.
Yeah.
But he's brilliant. And
I
adore his Desert Session stuff.
I slightly take umbrage with the fact that Queens of the Stone Age is often described as a supergroup, because I don't think it is. I think it's a band that Dave Grohl plays with sometimes.
He played on one album.
Yeah, but if you look them up, they're referred to as a supergroup. And I'm like, it's not really. It's just sometimes you've got a drummer from a different bands that comes and drums with you. That's not the same
I mean, he has a lot of... It's Josh Homme getting mates together on whoever he thinks might be good on the album or who's hanging around his desert studio.
But a supergroup doesn't count if it's, like, people that have been in bands previously that were less well-known. Yeah. That's not what... That's just your career as a musician.
But Eagles of Death Metal is, though, isn't
it? Eagles of Death Metal is a supergroup.
Because that's Josh Homme on drums, being quite a mediocre drummer. John Paul Jones on bass. And who's the guitarist? Can you remember?
No, I can't.
Oh, I'm going to look it up.
The other thing about Matt Berry that I always find quite odd is that he's in Moon.
Is he?
Yeah.
The
Sam Rockwell film. Yeah, he plays one of the like NASA people from back on Earth. And there's like two times that Rockwell gets a recording from Earth. And there's two like scientist people. And Matt Berry's one of them.
Okay.
And I remember the first time I watched that film, I was like, that's a weird... Casting.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
I saw that Zoe Bowie, what's his director's
Duncan Jones.
Name? Duncan Jones has written, I can't remember what game he was playing. He was playing a computer game. Liked it so much that he wrote a film script, a screenplay, a fan fiction that he says is unfilmable because of... The fact that it's so embedded in this game.
Right.
However, he's put it up for free as a PDF. So you can read the latest 2020 Duncan Jones film script for free on his Twitter right now if you want.
That's amazing.
Isn't that a cool thing
to do? That's very cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I really just sort of finish off by just saying if you are a fan of any sort of contemporary British comedy, as that review said, and you've not seen Garth Marenghi, go back and watch it because it's really interesting to see the roots of these people like Richard Ayoade, Matt Berry, Julian Barrett, where they really kind of started. If you're a fan of the Mighty Boosh, if you're a fan of the IT Crowd or Toast, go and, go back and watch Garth Marenghi because it's really interesting to see the kind of germs of what the characters they would find later on would become.
Really, really joyful way to spend an evening. Thank you so much, Ben.
Yeah.
What a wonderful suggestion.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Ben.
Looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely. So next week we will be looking back once more at the wonderful moonlighting.
Yeah. Great fun.
So, we will, pick an episode, have a little look, see if anything's particularly resonating for the moment. We will see you back here. Same time, same place next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, let us know what you think about Garth Marenghi. Let us know what you think about Stephen Merchant and Bob Mortimer, maybe being in some kind of period thing together. We could try and get some funding and make
That would be really nice.
I feel like it'll just settle me. I just feel like there's something unfinished now that I've had that dream.
Yeah, because
I feel like I need to complete it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the words of Will.i.am, there are forces at work that we are not aware of. This was his explanation to accidentally pressing the buzzer and turning around on The Voice the other day.
He's such a tit. You know where to find us. That is, of course, on Twitter, at Macabre Podcaster. You could get in touch with us on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. You can shoot us an email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. And of course, please do like, share, subscribe, and all that lovely stuff on Anchor, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts from.
I'm going to leave you with my favourite Garth Marenghi's Dark Place quote. Be he human, be he inhuman, whoe'er he be, often he's both. I've been Callum Hughes.
I've been David Shopland.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. I'm a one-track lover, down a two-way lane, driving fast down the highway, must have been insane, 'cause the temperature's too high, traveling way too fast, and I knew our love